Just how did 33 Chilean miners survive for 69 days trapped underground? Hector Tobar will join us to talk about his new book, Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free.
I say that when those drillers found that men, they began to weep and they cried like men do when their sons are born and when their mothers die.
What does it take to record Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow in its entirety twice? Veteran audiobook narrator George Guidel will be here to tell us about it.
My job is to put an emotional value on that information in some way, wrap the listener in so that he doesn't close his eyes.
Alexander Alter will join me with notes from the publishing world, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Hector Tobar joins us now. He is the author of Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. Hi, Hector.
Hello.
You came to the writing of this book in an interesting way. The miners picked you.
Yes, they did. The world didn't know it, but while they were still trapped, they made an agreement among themselves while they were still 2,000 feet underground, 700 meters below the surface, trapped in stone. They knew they were going to be rescued in a few days, and they had a final meeting down below in one of these caverns in which they decided that they would all tell their story together. And they would tell it to one writer and to one filmmaker. They wouldn't split off and sell off their individual rights. They would stick together through a series of contacts with attorneys in Santiago, Chile, and New York, New York. I ended up being the writer chosen to do the story.
And had you been covering this story for the LA Times, or were you new to it?
I was completely new to it. I was Buenos Aires bureau chief of the Los Angeles Times, but my term abroad had ended, and I was living in Los Angeles, and I followed it on television, on cable TV, like the rest of the world did, like the 1.2 billion people who saw them rescued on live television.
What drew you to the story? What made you want to write a book about this?
Well, you know, as a reporter for the LA Times and as a journalist and novelist, I'd spent my whole career writing about working people and trying to find sort of the epic and the poetic in the everyday lives of especially Spanish-speaking working people in both the United States and Latin America. And so when I heard the story, I just felt, I can do something with this. This is, you know, probably the most famous rescue adventure of the 21st century so far, and I'm going to be given free rein with the story. Several quick books had come out, quick and dirty books, which involved no real cooperation from the miners. And I thought, if I'm allowed to spend hours talking with these guys, I'm going to probably come up with a good story. So, and it turned out to be this incredible, almost, you know, mythic, epic folk tale of these men trapped in this mountain. And I learned all these wonderful things about mining as a culture and about these men who, you know, most of them went into the mine because they had families to support or families that were starting. Several had girlfriends and wives who were pregnant. And it ended up being a story about family and family love, and that was something I didn't quite expect.
I'd like to talk, before we get to the extraordinary story, a little bit about the daily lives of these miners, because I was once in a silver mine in Bolivia, and I lasted about 20 minutes before I had to, you know, run out the opposite end. It's, even on a daily basis, it's quite an extraordinarily difficult experience to be in one of these mines. What is the working life of these miners like, even when they're not trapped underground?
Well, in this particular mine, it was sort of a medium-sized family-owned mine in northern Chile. And so the work was to drive into the earth on a road, on a highway that spirals down, you know, 2,000 feet into the ground. And as you got deeper into the mine, it got hotter and hotter, also more humid, thanks to the geothermal heat of the earth and the very poor ventilation in this mine. It was just not well ventilated. And in addition to that, you know, most of these men had been working in mines, many of them since they were teenagers. So they were sort of used to these conditions. These were especially poor conditions. Many of them were kind of older men who couldn't get jobs at better mines. You know, it was very difficult working conditions because also they were breathing in a lot of dust and dirt. Many of them would not eat breakfast before they set off to work in the morning because they knew they would throw up their breakfast after a couple of hours of working in these conditions. So it was really, really hard work, but it was relatively well paid. Even the lowest paid guide would get like $1,200, $1,300 a month, which in Chile is a lot of money for a working person. And they had kind of middle class, lower middle class lifestyles. They had kids in college, car loans, mortgages, divorce payments, you know, all the accoutrement of middle class life they were able to pay with these jobs, which were dangerous, but also very fulfilling for them, because in Chile, you know, to be a miner is sort of like being a man. And so to them, it was very fulfilling work.
What were they mining?
They were mining gold and copper. The copper, you can actually see in the ore. It's beautiful. I describe it in the book, these marbled speckles of ore, of stone that you could see, the copper. The gold is invisible, and just a few grams come out of every ton that they would bring out of the mountain, and it'd have to be processed to get the gold. But some of the men had lived in mining so long, they believed that they could taste the gold if they put it to their mouth. They could taste what stone had gold and which did not. So it was gold and copper.
In Chile, in Bolivia, they chew coca leaves the entire time they're down there, in part, I think, to deal with the oppressive conditions. Is it like that in Chile, or how do they cope with these conditions?
A lot of them would look forward to their lunch break. 1 o'clock, they'd come out and come to the surface. It was very, very tough on their bodies. There's no doubt about that. They would work 7 days straight, 7 days, 12 hours a day. That was their shift, 7 days on, 7 days off. And on the days off, you know, I think it was that was really what allowed them to cope with it, just being able to go back to family. And a lot of them were pretty hard drinkers. One of them was actually hungover the morning before his shift was to start and almost didn't make it to work. You know, all the different ways that men and women have of dealing with really difficult jobs, you know, of finding solace in family and in drink.
Okay, let's go back to 2010. What happened? How did the mine collapse?
Well, this mine is composed mostly of diorite stone, which is a very, very hard stone like granite. And within this diorite mountain, there is a vein of ore that's softer. And so over the course of more than 120 years, they had been hollowing out this mountain. And they had faith that the people who owned the mine had faith that the mine would stick together because the diorite rock was so hard. So it was basically like the basic structure of the mine was solid and safe. But what happened is that through 120 years of hollowing it out, that stone didn't have anything to hold it up anymore, and eventually it just collapsed. It collapsed in one massive block over the course of a few minutes. According to a Chilean government report that came out later, this stone weighed twice the size of the Empire State Building. It was as tall as a 45-story building, and it just came crashing down through the ramp that led down into the mine, which was really the only way out. And so they were trapped. They could not get to the surface because the stone was blocking their way out. And the collapse itself was this horrific event, this terror-inducing event, because it was like living an earthquake underground. A lot of the men said they saw these very hard stone walls of the mine undulate, all the passageways filled with dust and rock. So it was a very horrific event. And when they tried to get to the surface, when everything calmed down, they saw this massive, brand-new stone wall blocking the way out. Some of them called it, it looked like a guillotine. Another miner said it was like the stone they put before Jesus' tomb. And when they saw that, they knew that they were in a very bad situation.
How were they discovered? How were they found?
At first, the Chilean government, local police, local miners sent down rescue teams to try to climb down there, but it was very quickly evident that that was too dangerous, that there was really no way to reach them. So they began to drill pilot holes from the surface, holes that were about 4 to 6 inches in diameter. And so they drilled these very long pilot holes from the surface, and it was like trying to aim for a small target because they had to drill through 2,000 feet of rock, and these drills would bend, you know, the hole would bend as they went through the rock. And so eventually one of these 16th or 17th pilot hole actually managed to break through and find the men in this small room that they call the refuge.
How long did it take between the collapse and finding the men?
It was 17 days, 17 very difficult days because the men had very little food. They had enough emergency provisions to last 25 men for 2 days. And of course there was 33 of them, and 2 weeks passed and then longer before they were found. And they ended up rationing their food to a single cookie a day, with a spoonful of tuna and some dirty industrial water that was down there with them. And then they ate once every 2 days, and they quickly began to lose weight. Many of them lost 20, 30, 40 pounds while they were trapped down there.
What were the other physical challenges about with being trapped down there for so long?
Starvation itself just causes a series of physical maladies, including kidney failure. And when they were finally found, they were tested by sending strips down from the surface, urine test strips, and they found out half of them were suffering from the early stages of kidney failure. But beyond that, starving to death in the dark created this really deep psychological torment. And then this weakness, you know, a lot of the men began to have very strange and very lucid dreams. And I recount these dreams in the book because they were just so fascinating to me, dreams in which they imagine family members trying to rescue them, or which they say goodbye to family members, or which should family members arrive with food for them. So it was this process of both physical and mental deterioration. I had the good fortune to have access to a complete video that was shot just days after they were found, when the Chilean government sent down a camera, and I could just see the physical degradation of them. They looked like, as I describe in the book, mushroom men. They were just very, very pale. It was difficult for some of them to speak. They were emotionally battered. They looked like battered people to me, and it was even more evident once I had gotten to know them that I could see that the men that I had met in northern Chile and who I was interviewing were not the same men in that video. Those men had gone through something really horrific. And then after they were found, water began to pour into the mine, and it made it even more humid, and fungus began to grow, and so they suffered from various fungus infections, urine retention. It was difficult on their bodies.
Why did it take so long, once they were found, to be rescued?
Yes, because from the time that they were found, which was on the 17th day, to the time when they were finally lifted out, well, that was 69 days total, so 52 more days of them waiting. Well, you know, the original pilot hole that found them, the original drill hole, was just 4.5 inches in diameter, which was just enough to lower food and telephone connections and whatnot. And so to get them out, they had to drill a hole that was about 24, 25 inches in diameter. And no one had ever dug a hole that deep, that wide in Chile before. And not only that, but they had to drill it at an angle because of where the men were and where they could drill on the surface. So it was a very complicated technical task. And in fact, the Chilean government ended up with three different drill projects, a Plan A, Plan B, and Plan C, trying to reach the men simultaneously. At one point, the drill that eventually found them, which was being directed by a man from the United States who had actually come from Afghanistan because he had been drilling wells for the troops, this drill bit broke, and they had to lose 4 or 5 days trying to get the broken bit out of the hole. So it was a very complicated technical task. No one had ever done a rescue that deep before. They ended up being trapped, you know, longer than anybody else in human history in the Guinness Book of World Records. And it was just a very difficult technical task. The Chilean government had to build a capsule to bring them out. It was built by the Chilean Navy and the foundry in Talcahuano, Chile, and with some help from NASA, some technical help. And so it was a very complicated process to take these men out.
In a very different way, obviously, this is a complicated story to tell, because while you have this terrific narrative with a clear, you know, beginning and middle and end and sort of aftermath, you've got 33 characters among the miners alone. How did you handle that structurally?
That was very difficult, but it quickly emerged to me that there were several different types of guys down there, and there were also a handful of men who played extremely critical roles in one way or another in the story. Very quickly it emerged that the guy who was the most important figure and the dominant personality down below was Mario Sepulveda, who I call in the book the man with the heart of a dog, because his nickname is Perry, and he says that his nickname is Perry from Perrito, which means little dog, and he says that's because I have the heart of a dog. He was low on the hierarchy of the mining team down there. He was the operator of a front loader. But he quickly emerged as the person who sort of took over and said, we're going to get out of here. But he's also a person with incredible emotional mood swings. He would go from being just inspiring and uplifting to being depressed and sullen. He would get in fights with people, and he was going through these incredible mood swings. And half the people down there loved him and said, you know, Mario was our leader, he rescued us, and the other half hated him. So Mario emerged as a really, really dominant figure in the story. And then there were other people who played key roles, like Luis Ursúa, who should have been and was nominally the boss down there, but who very quickly said, I'm not the boss anymore. This is beyond me. I don't know what to do. And gave up his role as boss temporarily, especially those first 17 days. Then there were groups of older men who had lived through mining disasters before. And among them, there were a few who I chose as sort of representatives of that particular group. And one especially, Omar Regadas, who's a wonderful storyteller, and just had a great ear for the speeches that everybody made down below. And so Omar plays a big role in the story. And then also I found that, you know, a lot of these men had very complicated, very close relationships with their wives or girlfriends. And their wives or girlfriends had amazing stories to tell about what happened on the surface. And so, you know, like, it was like a novel. I just realized I had to, these other threads, these other points of view that I should work into the story. And I think what holds it all together is just the momentum of what's going to happen next. And also just how we get to know these men and how much they love their families and how much their families are fighting for them on the surface.
I think like a novel, too, there are so many moments in this narrative of deep emotion, the moment when they realize they're trapped, the moment when they are discovered, the moment when they're rescued, the moment when their loved ones, you know, go through each of these various stages. What for you in writing this story and in researching it and talking to the miners was the sort of most emotional moment?
Well, there's a couple of them. I think that, you know, I interviewed several of the drillers, and I interviewed the drillers who found the men who, you know, drilled that first pilot hole. And talking to them about what it was like to drill what was the greatest hole in their lives, you know, the greatest thing they've ever done as working men, to find 33 men alive, trapped in stone. That was very emotional for me and for them. I say that when those drillers found the men, they began to weep, and they cried like men do when their sons are born and when their mothers die. You know, it was just that kind of emotion. And then with the men themselves who were trapped below, just the spirituality that they had to get in touch with because they were facing death. And they were facing death in a really sort of slow and torturous manner. I mean, they were slowly dying. The very place that they were in felt like a coffin. It was dark. The lights were getting dimmer as the days went by until they found a way to recharge the batteries in their lamps. And so for them, it was a very existential thing. To have them break down before me, many of them broke down before me describing what it was like to face the possibility of their deaths and the knowledge that their families would have to go on without them. Many had lost their own fathers when they were young, and now we're going to leave this legacy to their children of a life without a father, of a life without a provider. And that's a very difficult thing for a man to face. I'm very fortunate. I have three kids and married for a long time, and I know what it's like to assume that responsibility of being a parent. And the idea that you're going to leave your kids behind is a tough one. And so that, to me, was it was something that I felt very emotionally when I interviewed the men.
Such a powerful story. Hector Tovar, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
The book, again, is Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. Alexandra Alter joins us now with Notes from the Publishing World. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
All right, you've promised to tell us a story.
Yes, I know we're here to talk about the National Book Awards. As you were there last night, it was a really exciting ceremony. But first, I want to tell you about my commute this morning.
Doesn't that sound so much more exciting?
And I promise it's related. So I'm on the F train at about 10:30, and a tall man in a suit approaches another commuter who's reading Colin McCann and says to the person reading the book, "Can I take your picture? He's my mentor." The person asks, "Oh, and who are you?" And he says, "I'm Phil Cly, the fiction winner from last night." So it turns out he was on his way from Brooklyn to NPR to do an interview, of course. He'd just gotten off the phone with The Guardian. He was very giddy and stunned still. He was with his wife. So I introduced myself, and we chatted a little bit, and I said, "Congratulations." And he said he's, you know, working on a novel, and he's gotten a lot of really kind notes of congratulation from other veterans who are also, you know, many of them are also writing on their own. So that was a funny coincidence.
That was your Phil Klein moment.
That was my Phil Klein moment. And because I was busy last night covering the awards, I didn't get to interview him. I just covered his speech. So.
Well, Phil Klein is such a gentleman that for about 30 minutes earlier this year when I recorded, interviewed him on the podcast, he refrained from correcting me on the mispronunciation of his name. So it is Klein, not Clay,
That's
as I
right.
once said. Tell us about last night.
So I thought it was a really exciting ceremony. You know, compared to previous years, it seemed like there was a lot of energy. And Daniel Handler, a.k.a. Lemony Snicket, was a very edgy, entertaining host. He made some jokes that I understand have some people upset, a lot of cracks about Jeff Bezos and Amazon and things like that. And in terms of the winners, I thought it was interesting. It sort of split between newcomers and people who had been nominated a number of times.
Jacqueline Woodson, of course.
Jacqueline Woodson had been a finalist three times and finally won for her memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming, which has gotten an incredible review in the book review. And she seemed very, very excited about that.
I urge readers listeners to go back and Google that one. Veronica Chambers wrote the review, and it was one of the most positive, emotional reviews that we've had in the kids' pages in a long time.
And it's also, it seemed like an interesting form, too. It was a memoir in verse, you know, and you're seeing a lot of memoirs being written for young adults these days. So I thought that was a nice choice. And in poetry, Louise Gluck won for Faithful and Virtuous Night. She said it was her fourth time being a finalist.
Wow. And who won in nonfiction?
So Evan Osnos won for Age of Ambition, which is his look at China's rise as a global economic superpower. And he's been covering that for The New Yorker, of course. But I think that the judges sort of cited his look at this particular moment in China's rise as a global power and what it means for not just China, but for the world. And I thought his acceptance speech was rather touching because he thanked the people that, you know, were willing to take a risk by talking to him. He said, these people live, you know, in a society where you can't be vulnerable, you can't be honest. And, you know, they were really taking, you know, a great danger to themselves, a risk by talking to him for the book.
And speaking of emotional, Phil Klein's acceptance speech.
Yes. That was very, very touching. I mean, he was sort of choking up at a number of points, but he really seemed to feel like writing the book was a way for him to absorb and process his experiences and sort of communicate, you know, what it was like.
All right. Well, listeners can watch the entire ceremony, apparently, on C-SPAN if they're not content just listening to us chat about it. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks for having me.
Pirate has become famous for his banana breakfasts. Messmates throng here from all over England, even some who are allergic or outright hostile to bananas, just to watch for the politics of bacteria the soil's stringing of rings and chains in nets only God can tell the meshes of have seen the fruit thrive often to lengths of a foot and a half. Yes, amazing, but true.
George Guidel joins me now. He narrates the audiobook version of Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon, which is reviewed this week by Tom McCarthy in the book review. Hi, George.
Hello there.
You have recorded how many audiobooks now?
1,270-something.
Is that the record?
I think it is, yeah. I don't think anybody's lived that long.
That is very impressive. I want to talk to you a lot about audiobook recording in general, but let's talk first about Gravity's Rainbow. This book you recorded in 1986.
Yes, a long time ago.
And what happened to that recording?
Well, it was something with the rights, or it just disappeared. There are a few copies floating around. But I'm so glad that we're doing a new one because I'm a little older and I understand a little more about what I'm doing.
Did you have to re-record the entire thing?
Oh, sure, yeah. It's a brand new recording, beautifully done in terms of the recording, and with Professor Weissenberger's companion, it was not as difficult as it was without that companion. This time I had Steven Weissenberger's companion book, which explains a lot of the things that Pynchon talks about that even I, at my age, didn't really remember from the World War II times. And we're talking about a time that was in the 1940s that is in the book. So there's a lot of references, especially in England, that if not for Weisenberger's work, I would not know what he was talking about.
Is it important to know what the author is talking about when you're recording the audiobook?
That's a great question. Yes. As far as I'm concerned, as an audiobook narrator, my responsibility is to get an overall emotional arc going for the book that involves the reader at some point. It's not a question of knowing exactly what Pynchon meant, as it is knowing exactly what Pynchon wanted people to feel. And that's my department as an actor and an audiobook narrator. What we have is a book that's essentially a multi-leveled metaphor of an age. If we can imagine a painting done as a group with Dali, Bruegel, and M.C. Escher together, the end result of that painting would be something similar to what Pynchon painted for us on the page. My job is to paint it vocally so that you get the emotional value of that thing, making it more experiential, because I'm not a writer. I'm a performer.
This is not an easy novel to read, but it must be, in many ways, even harder to narrate.
Yes, it is. It is a difficult narration, and I was daunted by it. It's quite a challenge, but I went back to, I've done Cervantes' Don Quixote, I've done Les Miserables, unabridged narration, and there's something that stays with me in terms of feeling the overall experiential value of the book. My job is not to give you information. That's Pynchon's job. My job is to put an emotional value on that information in some way, wrap the listener in so that he doesn't close his eyes. That's part of the objective of an audiobook narrator. He wants to create a relationship with the listener to bring to the author's work a kind of emotional immediacy. If that can be done, then it's up to the reader to know what the author's talking about.
Now, there are, just to get to the sort of nitty-gritty, some technical challenges with this novel. What makes it so hard to narrate Gravity's Rainbow?
Well, first of all, there are several times in the book where these incredibly complicated mathematical equations are written down. Math is not my strong point, but luckily, I have a family member who is a professor of mathematics at Georgia Institute of Technology. His name is Brett Wick, and he's a terrific mathematician, and I called him. And I said, look, I'm going to send you these faxed copies of these equations. Please tell me what they are. And he talked to me on the phone and started to explain the equation to me. Well, I don't need the explanation. I just know how to say them. I just want to know how to read it. And he said, oh, that's easy. And he just rattled it off. And I had him on my cell phone. So when it came time to that, I could just do what he did. But the explanation was more frightening than the formulas themselves.
It's not just math, right? There are other technical challenges.
There's a lot of technical challenges. Yeah, much of it is in words. That words are my is what I work with. So that I could do. Some of the stuff that I didn't understand, I had various people that I know to explain some things to me, physicists, scientists, just so that I know what I'm talking about most of the time. But it's the breadth of subject matter in that book, which is incredible. He talks from physics to math to relativity to mental health. You have to have a kind of a broad understanding of the emotional point of departure that makes a guy talk like that, because ultimately it has to be somebody talking.
It's a lot of talking.
Yes, it's a lot of talking. That's why it has to have variety in it, and it has to be interesting. It's not a matter of giving people information. It's a matter of giving people some kind of sense of something is happening now. It's an immediacy that makes an audiobook work. You feel as if you're there. In all the books that I've done, people write me fan letters and they say, you know, I'm thankful for traffic jams, and I'm always coming home with the frozen food melting in the back seat because I have to listen to the end of the chapter at the end of the book. It's that kind of involvement that you look for, to have people want to know what's happening because it's happening with them.
It would have to be one hell of a traffic jam to get you to the end of Gravity's Rainbow.
No, you'd probably cause a traffic jam.
Yes, it's 30 CDs. How long did it take?
Better part of, I guess, a month. It was intense all day long, just making sure that I would ask to have it played back to me so that it feels as if I am indeed talking to people and letting the people see what's happening. Somebody told me a long time ago, don't tell, show. I have penchant telling, but I have to show them, the listeners, what is happening in some way so that in their mind's eye, they see what's happening. In the review of Gravity's Rainbow, he's very good to notice my inner monologue of maniacal behavior and mm-hmm. paranoia and desperation, because it's all there. It's all part of the book.
Do you always read the books before, you know, and from beginning to end before you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I don't trust anyone who says, I don't read the book beforehand, because it breaks it for me. I just like to go into the sound booth and record. I have to know how the story ends before I can begin it. And I have to know what surprises are on the way, because when you start narrating, it's kind of a toboggan ride. You start with an emotional point of departure in the beginning, and you just go. And part of the work of the director is to stop me every once in a while and say, did you pay attention to this, or let's do this, or let's put another color in there somewhere. So, but you have to read the book first.
I want to share with our listeners some of the titles, of the many titles, given that you've done over 1,000 of these, of the books that you've narrated, just to give a sense of the scope. You have done, as you mentioned earlier, Les Miserables, The Iliad, Marcel Proust's Remembrance of Things Past, and Swan's Way, a number of books by Philip Roth. I'm not sure if that means every book.
Almost all of them.
The Corrections, another Victor Hugo, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Elie Wiesel's Night. That must have been, I imagine, subject matter-wise, not easy, but at least a short one.
Don't forget Wiley Lamb's books, too, because Wiley Lamb is one of those authors who includes a large scope of what it means to be a human being. And I Know This Much Is True and The Hour I First Believed, especially, were terrific books.
And everything from Alan First to Dostoevsky. So a real wide range. You have on your website a little bit about some of your favorites, but tell us, do you have a favorite book that you just really loved or meant a lot to you to be able to record?
One of my favorites is Craig Allen Johnson's series on Longmire that later became a TV show. There's great humanity in that, and there's humor, and also they're westerns. But so there's not really one famous book. I guess if it push came to shove, I would include Wiley Lamb with Cervantes and Dostoevsky and Les Miserables by Victor Hugo. These, because the classics have a depth that a lot of other books don't. The simple depth of humanity in the books I am attracted to, and the words also are kind of beautiful. It's reading, especially the Proust thing, I use that as an example in the library shows, and people are just moved. I think they think of Proust and they immediately kind of are repelled by, boy, that's too intellectual. But when they hear it performed, it becomes immediate to them, and they say, boy, I'd like to read that and see what it's like. And as an actor, I just am so grateful to be able to do that to people. And they leave these programs with a list of books that they want to listen to because of the excerpts that I've read to them. It's an incredible experience.
I'm going to get away from the scary word best. And what books are particularly fun to record?
Well, I started years ago a series by Lillian Jackson Braun, the Cat Who series, the Cat Who read Brahms, the Cat Who solved murders. It's a law. I think she wrote something like 31 books. And when it was first given to me, I thought it was just trivial and I couldn't be bothered with it. I'm even allergic to cats. But it's all about how these two cats help this man solve crimes. And the studio manager said, just try this one book. Just try this one. And if you don't like it, you don't have to do it. Well, I did that one. And the reaction of listeners was amazing. It was such a joyous kind of thing. It's such a major distraction from people's daily lives. Nobody thinks about their mortgage or their debts, the debts that they have, or the car accident, etc. They're all listening to two cats solve crimes in a town in which all kinds of horrible things happen. Arson, burglary, murder, all kinds of things. But nobody cares about that because they're waiting for the cats to find the clue that solves the murder. So that kind of humor, that kind of tongue-in-cheek representation of a place that doesn't exist, exists in their in these people's minds because I made it, I helped it become real for them. That's a kind of nice thing. I love that.
Is it hard to narrate a book when you don't get the book or you don't just doesn't speak to you or you don't like it?
A long time ago, someone said to me, and I was in a show at the time, and this guy said to me, "You're not crazy about this play, are you?" And I said, "No, not really." And I was just beginning. And he said, "Well, let me tell you, a professional is someone who likes what he does, even when he doesn't love doing it." And that kind of stayed with me over the years. I'm not an arbiter of taste. I don't tell people what books to enjoy. If one or two people can enjoy my work, that's fine. Isn't that a line in Shakespeare? The censure of the one must outweigh a whole theater of others. There's somebody who's going to enjoy that book. And as long as it's not gratuitously violent or gratuitously full of sensation that is not necessary, I do the book and I enjoy trying to make it work. It's part of my job as a performer.
There's such a huge variety in audiobooks these days. Some of them are highly produced, and there's music and sound effects, and some narrators choose to do voices, and others, you know, just do a sort of a straight narratorial voice. Do you have your own approach and your own preferences?
Yes, I do have my own approach. We don't do music. Most of the books I do not have a musical accompaniment. I do voices. I think it's important for a listener to know who's talking. And when there are more than three or four people in a scene, you've got to have some kind of variety so that the listener doesn't have to stop experiencing the book and say, "Now who's talking?" That has to be done. Otherwise, you're reading out loud and just giving information. There's a degree of performance involved in narration that makes it clear who's talking. In fact, we're doing a book now that the author very seldom says he says or she said or so-and-so said, and sometimes you have to figure out who's talking.
Do you test out voices? Do you practice and say, okay, this is going to be this character, and sort of figure out?
Every novel has about three, maybe four major characters that you can't really fool around with. There are a lot of peripheral characters that vocally you can paint different vocal portraits with, which are important to the experience. They're different people. So, yes, I don't do anything beforehand. I have the basic characters in my mind. I've read the book. I know how it's going to end. I know I have a feeling what the author intends the reader to feel as the book starts. And as far as the peripheral characters, that happens in the booth. If one person is saying something in the lower register, I've got to have another person in a higher register somewhere so that the listener knows who's talking.
Circling back to Gravity's Rainbow, you mentioned that, you know, you having recorded it in 1986 and then recording it again this year, that you understood the novel a lot more. Were there any other changes in terms of how you approach the actual narration?
Of course there were. This was done about, 30 years ago, the first one. It was in the 80s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was 30 years younger, which means I've lived a lot and read a lot and are more familiar with the kind of emotional variety that exists in the book. Just as an older person and who has a little more experience, I felt that I was better equipped vocally and technically to handle a book like that than I was 30 years ago. I listened to some of it that I did then, and I was frankly turned off by it because I was much younger and I had no variety in it, and I could tell that narrator, whoever that guy was anxious to finish the book. was eager and anxious.
And this time you actually understood the math.
No, I didn't understand. I have no idea how I did that math then. I don't remember how I did the math, to tell you the truth. But I'm sure you take any narrator worth his salt and compare a book that he did at one age and a book that he did 30 years ago, certainly you would hope that his performance is deeper and more attractive.
George Guidel, a pleasure talking to you.
My pleasure indeed. I'm glad that we had this chat. I would just wish people would give the audiobook experience a little more chance. And especially I'm thrilled that the book review has done this. It's I'm very, very thankful and I'm grateful for it.
I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again. George Guidel, narrator of Gravity's Rainbow, reviewed this week in the book review by Tom McCarthy. Greg Coles joins me now with Bestseller News. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new?
Well, not a whole lot on the fiction list. There are just three new titles. Douglas Preston and Lincoln Child have a new one in their Pendergast series. That's Blue Labyrinth, new at number 5. Patricia Cornwell also continues her Scarpetta series. The 22nd book in that is Flesh and Blood. It's new at number 3. And finally, new at number 1, Stephen King has a new book out. It's getting some of his best reviews in a while. It's a book called Revival. Not that he needs a career revival, but there it is at number 1.
All right, a bunch of unknowns on the fiction list. And nonfiction?
Nonfiction, there's some more titles. There's 6 new books over in nonfiction, including No Hero by Mark Owen. That is the Navy SEAL, whose real name is Matt Bissonnette. He's written a follow-up to No Easy Day with Kevin Moorer once again. That book is new at number 11. Then at number 8, there's kind of a weird book for the bestseller list. It's a book by a Canadian hedge fund manager, Marin Katusa, who specializes in the energy industry. It's a book called The Colder War. He's arguing that Vladimir Putin is trying to control the world's energy market. Then Amanda Palmer's The Art of Asking, new at number 7. Amanda Palmer is famous. She really got her start as a rock star, one member of the punk cabaret duo Dresden Dolls. And now she's also famous as a wife. She's Neil Gaiman's wife. And so they married their fortunes together. She doubled her fan base, at least. And her book, The Art of Asking, is really about the art of asking people for favors as an artist, how you build an audience. It has one of the great blurbs in recent memory from Elizabeth Gilbert, who says, "At first you find yourself thinking, goodness, what a crazy world that Amanda Palmer inhabits. How does she possibly endure it? Then gradually, as you read along, a doorway opens up in your heart and you realize, I want to live in a world exactly like hers. God willing, this book will show us all how to do it."
She blurbs that on every book, doesn't she?
I'm not sure if it's a real recommendation or if it's a description of Stockholm Syndrome, but the book is probably worth a look. The next three titles new to the nonfiction list, Anne Lamott has another kind of religious self-help book called Small Victories, new at number 5. Andy Cohen, the reality TV producer, he's the executive producer of Real Housewives. He's also the host of Bravo's Watch What Happens Live, has a book called The Andy Cohen Diaries, new at number 4. And new at number 1 this week, the former president George W. Bush has a profile of the former president George H.W. Bush, his father, called 41. That's new at number 1.
All right. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.